Welcome to Chapter 7, Stock Price Behavior and Market Efficiency. Now, if I were going to name this chapter, I would name it, Can You Beat the Market? Or Who Can Beat the Market? Because that's pretty much what the theme of this chapter is. And as we've said, we have done the heavy lifting. We have done the most important studying and calculations with regard to stocks. And now it's time to talk about some of the silliness that goes on with regard to stocks. And it's nothing new. Nothing new at all. In fact, here's a quote from Sir Isaac Newton. Yes, that Isaac Newton. The apple, gravity, force equals mass times acceleration. Because he learned the hard way, as many investors do. I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men. And how did he learn? Well, he got involved in one of the manias of the day. I think it was called the South Sea Islands project or partnership or something. And it wasn't a Ponzi scheme like a pyramid scheme, but it certainly was a spectacular disaster for those who invested. So remember, I told you about extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds. It's discussed that one of that financial disasters is discussed in that book. So slide number 2, let's get started on random walks and efficient markets. The random walk hypothesis is the theory that stock price movements are unpredictable. In other words, you're better off just throwing darts at a dartboard than trying to predict stocks, and because you're going to probably follow the crowd and see what's hot. Whereas the theory shows us that stock price movements are completely random, unpredictable. Well, in the short term, yes, they're absolutely right. They do appear random. But in the long term, no, stocks are not random in the long term. If you go back over 100 years, 200 years, you find that stocks in general, of course, you know, looking at the entire market as a whole, some companies do really well, some do badly, some disappear, some explode onto the scene. But as a whole, the market has gone up quite nicely, thank you very much, average annual return. Why? Because the global economy has expanded quite nicely over the last 200 years. And as we said, capitalism might be the worst economic system out there for delivering goods and services to a population, except for all the others. And so if we take a long-term perspective and the world doesn't end, which is always a distinct possibility, we should do well. We'll do better than randomly watch our portfolio bounce up and down. Failure is not an option, folks, because I don't know about you, but do you know how to feed yourself if there were no food? I heard that digging for betel grubs is pretty effective, lots of protein, and boiling bark for dinner, moth soup. Anyway, let's continue. The efficient market hypothesis is often coupled with the random walk hypothesis, and what these efficient market theorists say is that the market is, if a market is large enough, it will be efficient. If there are sufficient numbers of buyers and sellers, like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or any of the large exchanges around the world, if there are large numbers of knowledgeable investors who react quickly to new information, then security prices will adjust quickly and accurately. See, now, what they're saying is the price that you see on the New York Stock Exchange, on the NASDAQ at any one time, is the perfect price. That is exactly what that security should be priced. This assumes that people are rational, but we know that they're not, and we've seen situations where this is just not true. If you're really interested in this efficient market, random walk idea, then there's a fabulous book, which you've already mentioned, The Random Walk Down Wall Street. And the gentleman who, the professor who wrote this book, was one of the researchers who was working on efficient market theories. And he's got a great sense of humor. He skewers the fundamental analysts, which is what we did in chapters 6 and 7. He skewers the technical analysis, which we'll do in chapter 8. And then he skewers the efficient market theorist, which he's part of. He believes, like me, that everybody should be insulted. Exactly. Equal opportunity. Some people say, you're discriminatory. You're discrimination. No, you're practicing discrimination. I say, no, I don't. I hate everybody the same. So let's continue. Along on slide number 3, along the same time as the efficient market theorists were developing their hypotheses, at the same time the physicists were dealing with certain types of physical laws, and they would have the weak theory and the weak force and the strong force and the semi-strong. So efficient market theorists stole from the physicists. So here's the weak efficiency hypothesis. Past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. Well, in other words, just because a stock has done well in the past is not a guarantee that it's going to do well in the future. We knew that already, didn't we? Yes, exactly. However, stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum. Stock prices tend to rise more often than they fall. Every 2 or 3 years, the stock market goes up. For every 1 year, it goes down. And they tend to move far higher than is usually justified into a mania, a bubble, or far lower than is usually warranted, a crash. And there's a wonderful quote by a gentleman by the name of John Maynard Keynes, Sir John Maynard Keynes, who has named after himself Keynesian economics. And this is the idea that government should spur the economy by deficit spending. And it's very controversial now. It's been being used to get us out of the Great Recession. And there are people who say that it didn't really help the world get out of the Great Depression, although most people in the world of economics would say, yes, it did. But others dispute that. And Mr. Keynes was very, very sharp, very smart. There was a time when stock prices were really high, and he was at this very, you know, high level discussions with a conference, and some of the traders, some of the speculators who had been betting against the market continuing to go up, complained to him that, hey, this is ridiculous. These prices are irrational. The stock market is irrational. The prices should fall. That's why we're shorting. We're trying to make money when the market goes down. We'll discuss shorting in detail at the end of the semester. Suffice to say, it's very dangerous. You can lose a lot of money quickly. But you're trying to make money when the market goes down. And his response was now immortalized. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Sure, you're absolutely right. You are correct. I believe also that stock prices are higher than they should be. But that doesn't mean that they won't stay high and they won't go higher, because we're not rational individuals. And so if you're going to bet that the market goes down, you're going to lose and lose and lose, and before you're proven right, you're going to be broke. And so remember that, folks. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Now, if this theory is true, then technical analysis, which we will cover in Chapter 8, is basically useless. And I agree, technical analysis is basically useless. But I don't necessarily agree that past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. In the short term, yes. But in the long term, providing the world doesn't end, I disagree. Slide number 4. The semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Semi-strong? Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. What does this mean? In other words, no amount of analysis that you do to determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market. If this theory is true, then what we did in chapter 6 and 7, fundamental analysis, is basically useless. The efficient market theorists say that you can't beat the market because it's random, because it's efficient. You should just not even try. But the problem with this theory is that there are many, many investors who have beaten the market over significantly long periods of time. And we'll look at some of the all-stars of investing later. So obviously you got a problem. You have a theory that says people can't beat the market, and yet there are a significant number of people who do. What does the theory say about those investors? The theory says they're lucky. Huh? They're lucky? Yeah, think about it. You have 10,000 people all assumingly, randomly buying and selling stocks. One or two of them are going to get it right. The problem with this is if you look at the numbers and the number of people who have done well, it's not like winning the lottery. There's more than just a handful of people who do this, who are able to do this. And that's not to say it's easy. It's not. It's not easy. But there are people who do it. And it reminds me of a very famous quote, which is attributed to several different golfers. If you look it up on the Infernal Net, you'll see that there are many different people who it's attributed to. But he did really, really, really well and beat all the other people. And a reporter, after the match or whatever it's called, the golf thing, said to him, "You know, you were really lucky out there today." And the golfer said, "You know, you're absolutely right, I was. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get." Yeah, there are some people who can hit a tiny little white ball 400 yards down the fairway in 3 shots. Ain't too many of them. There are some people who can kick a soccer ball and bend it 30 yards, bend it around 2 defenders and pass the goalie into the net. There are some people who can hit a fastball at 98 miles an hour. There are some people who can throw a fastball at 98 miles an hour. There aren't too many of them. And the ones that can, the more they practice, exactly. It's not easy, but people do it. And the truth be told, being a successful investor is not as hard as doing the things that we just discussed, those Herculean feats in some sports. Right? Yeah. But it still takes practice, patience, and a little bit of luck helps too. Slide number 5, the strong efficiency hypothesis. Well, this high part of the market efficiency theory says that no information, public or private, allows investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. That's ridiculous. One insider information trade can make you rich overnight if you don't get caught, that is. If you knew, for example, that one company was going to buy another company, the next day they were going to announce it, you could become filthy rich in one day. But you could also go to jail. If you have material non-public information, which is the legal term for insider information, about a company, and you act on that, you can make a fortune overnight, but if they catch you, if the Securities Exchange Commission catches you, you're going to go to jail. And that's, you heard of, what is her name? Martha Stewart. She got in trouble for this. And I'm sure that they did it on purpose. They said, yeah, go to jail just for a few months and you'll get all kinds of publicity. Yeah. Slide number 6. The random walk and efficient market theorists are often also proponents of index funds. Why? You understand? If people can't beat the market, you're better off just buying the market. They point to the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market, especially during bull markets. They tend to do better during bear markets. From 1963 to 1998, the S&P 500 index outperformed general equity mutual funds 22 out of 36 times. But that means that there are people who are doing well, right? The market theorists reason that you are better off accepting close to the market's return with low-cost index funds, since their theory tells them that no one can consistently beat the market. And the writer of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, Burton Malkiel, I hope I'm saying his name right, was one of the members of the board of directors of Vanguard when Vanguard was putting together the Index 500 fund. They weren't the only ones doing it. There were other entities dabbling with it, but Vanguard was certainly the most public and the most aggressive, and certainly now the most successful. Slide number 7. Let's take a look at more efficient market market efficiency rationale. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, there's a few very good reasons. Many mutual funds have high annual operating expenses and high turnover rates. So you got one hand tied behind your back already. Think about it, folks. If you're trying to match the S&P 500 and you have a 1 or 2% annual operating expense, you've got to beat the S&P 500 by 1 or 2% just to break even. You understand? And that is difficult if you have high turnover rates, because then you have more transaction costs. So you got the annual operating expenses, and if you have high turnover rates, you have high transaction costs. Plus, many mutual fund managements have very short-term time horizons, which means if you don't do well in 18 months or 2 years, which is a very short period of time for investors, you're out of there. So what typically happens, or it's not as bad as it used to be, but it was pretty rampant for several decades. Mutual fund managers knew, they're not stupid, they know that if they do really well, then they're going to get to stay, and they're going to get showered with love and attention and money. And if they don't do well, they're out of there within 2 years or sooner. So they would take large bets, figuring what does it matter? If I don't do well, I'm not going to leave it. I'm going to be gone anyway. So I'll take large bets and hopefully do well. Obviously, that didn't turn out very well for many mutual funds, and now mutual funds in general are giving their managers, in general, everyone's different, giving them more time, 4 years, 8 years, and relax. Come on, we want you here for the long term. So it is. It's difficult to beat the market because if you have annual operating expenses, you have to beat those, and you got to deal transaction costs. The S&P 500, there's no transaction costs. And the index fund has small transaction costs, but it still has costs. But the premises and casual observations of the efficient market theories show them to be patently absurd. Many money managers have beaten the market over significantly long periods of time. The more I practice, exactly, the luckier I get. Plus, dear students, if markets are efficient and rational, how do you explain on slide number 8, manias, also called bubbles? Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias, also known bubbles. The internet bubble of the late 1990s was the latest stock mania, okay? Before that, there were other stock manias. In the late 1960s, early 70s, there was the Nifty 50. Companies like CalComp and Metro Media and Xerox and Avon were bid up to huge prices, and these were the companies that you just couldn't lose. Polaroid, Some of you have never even seen a Polaroid camera. They went bankrupt in the 98, was it? The name is still around. They've attached a name to other different products, but they were cameras that you could see the result in 60 seconds. And I often thought it just wasn't a good idea to invest in a company whose name rhymes with hemorrhoid. I just don't think it's a good idea. Anyway, those companies are gone, right? Well, Xerox is still around, Avon's still around, but it's never returned to the stock price it hit back in 72. The mania, the stock market mania of the 1920s resulted in the crash of 1929. Companies, what were the internet companies then? What were the social media companies then? Automobiles, indeed. Radio. In fact, you've heard of a company called Radio Corporation of America, haven't you? Yeah, we know it is RCA. It hit 290, I think, 290 in 1929, and then 3 years later was down to $2. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. That was the technology of the day. How many railroad firms are there now? Less than a handful, less than five. But the granddaddy of all manias, folks, who knows? We're humans. We never learn. But the granddaddy of all manias was the Dutch tulip bulb craze of the early 1600s. Yes, dear students, you heard correctly. Tulip bulbs. Flowers. And tulips didn't come from the Netherlands. I think they came from Turkey. Right, they came from Turkey. And they were all the craze. To the point where tulip bulbs started to be traded like securities, like stocks and bonds. And at the height of the mania, one tulip bulb sold for what today would be $1.5 million. Some poor slob, a sailor, came into town, didn't know what was going on, saw one sitting on a table and thought it was an onion and ate it. Whew. Now, dear students, maybe you're not a gardener. I'm not one. I mean, I can plant a few things, but what happens when you put a tulip bulb into the ground? Right, it grows, and it does what most living things try, or all living things try to do. It reproduces. And so eventually, if tulip bulbs are being sold for $1.5 million, you're going to have tulip bulbs coming out of your ears. And sure enough, the price then simply plummeted. And there are two wonderful books that you already made mention of the one. I apologize, I was a little ahead of myself. The Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. This book was written in 1840, and it still shocks you at how insane a species we are. It doesn't tell you why. Nobody can tell you why. The best guesses are because that's the way we were pieced together in our DNA. But we are not rational individuals. We don't think clearly all the time. We see a bunch of people running one way. What do? We run with them. Now, why is that? Well, the gene theorists and some of the anthropologists and sociologists and all those soft science folks would say it's because of what happened 100,000 years ago and 200,000 years ago and a million years ago. Because if you stood back and watched all your friends run that way and you didn't run that way and you said, look at all these people running that way, you're the one who got eaten by the tiger. And you didn't get to propagate, you didn't get to pass on your genes. That's probably the reason, but we don't really know. I mean, how do you measure that? And another book called The Botany of Desire goes into detail about the tulip bulb craze of the 1640s. It's a wonderful book. He talks about how we think we're in control of the plants, the botany of desire. But no. The plants are in control of us. We get them to feed them. We get them to plant them. We get them to kill their pests. And who's in charge here? Yeah. So do read those books for fun and have a good time. Each time the phrase was, it's a new era. It's different this time. The old ways of valuing stock are gone, and you know what? Each time they're wrong. So when you hear it's a new era, it's different this time, you know, okay, the bubble's going to burst, you just don't know when. That's what I was saying to myself in 98, 99. It's going to end badly. And I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of people saying it's not going to end. I didn't think it was going to end. The end started in 2000, but I didn't think it was going to end that soon. And it reminds me of a Greek tragedy. You know, at the end of the play, there's going to be dead bodies everywhere, all over the stage. You just don't know how long it's going to be until it happens. Same thing is true with the crash in the housing in 2008. Well, it started in 2007 is when prices started falling, and then it spilled over to the rest of the economy. You knew there were going to be dead bodies everywhere. You just didn't know how long it was going to happen. And I think I've told you this. My buddy was saying, we were both of the opinion that it was a bubble and that it was going to burst. And he said, oh, it's going to go down 50-60% real estate. And I would say, you know, Jim, I don't think so. Real estate falling that far, I mean, you got to go back to the Great Depression. It just doesn't happen that often. And he said, no, I thought 20%, 25%. I thought the stock market was going to fall about 20-25%. He was absolutely right. But he was too soon. He made the same mistake that the gentleman who were talking with Sir John Maynard Keynes. The market was stayed irrational for my buddy far longer than he was able to stay solvent, because he was doing the same thing. He was betting that the housing market would fall, and he was absolutely right, but he was too soon. Slide number 9. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? Any ideas from the peanut gallery? Well, this is, when I open up to the face-to-face students. Here's a great quote. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. Doesn't mince words, does he? Leonard Kaplan, president of the commodities brokerage firm Prospector Asset Management in Evanston, Illinois. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Here is how our hero, Benjamin Graham, the writer, the author of The Intelligent Investor, said it. The speculative public is incorrigible. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. The abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. And this is from the 1972 edition, his last edition. He wrote 4 editions, the first one in 1949, and then after the 1972 edition, he passed away in 1975. So today, you would replace franchising, computers, electronic science, technology, etc., with internet and biotechnology, and good old Ben would have been writing in 2000 instead of 1972. But today, I'm sorry, if you would replace that in 2000, that you would replace it with internet and biotechnology. But today, you would replace it with social networking and China, and maybe 3D printing and all the other nanotechnologies that are going on. So you see, the technology changes humans maybe 10,000 years from now. I don't know, but it's going to take a while. Slide number 11. How do most manias end? All manias? Yeah, you guessed it. They invariably end with a crash because valuations just go way too high, and it's the Wile E. Coyote effect. The coyote runs out off of the ledge onto thin air, and it takes a while for him to figure out that, uh-oh, there's nothing underneath me. And I like this quote I've heard. I can't take credit for it. I don't remember where I heard it. It was a long time ago, but it's a great quote. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. Right. They're not fun to live through, folks, but the odds are you're going to live through at least one, probably two or three, because they seem to be happening sooner and sooner during your investing career. And you must be ready for them. You must be ready for them, not only intellectually, but emotionally, because they are sickening. They make you feel horrible. But they're the best thing that could happen to you if you're young. Why? You got it. You're buying shares at a lower price. And this was a gentleman who retired, actually, in 2000. He, when he said this, people thought, the guy's nuts, right? Listen to him. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. Now, in the chapter 4, I have a link to the obituary that was written by one of the LA Times writers, because this guy knew the American funds, knew this guy very, very well, and wrote a tremendous obituary about him. His name was John Lovelace, and he was the gentleman who basically made American Funds what it is. His father had started it, but he took the mantle and really turned them, made them the next level. Really did it great. His father was good, too. August 1999, the internet is raging, blue skies, productivity gains, we're all going to be rich, run down there, they're giving away free money. And he says, with this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. Oh boy, was he right. And he had 50 years of experience when he said it. Oh, by the way, I think we made this mention, the 2008-2009 market crash was not caused by a stock market bubble. The stock market was not in a bubble in 2008. I don't care what anybody says. By any stretch of the imagination, the valuations were not stretched that large. It was the real estate valuations that were stretched to extremes. And the mortgage-backed bonds that were tied to the mortgages of those houses that in 1999 were selling for $300,000 and then at the bubble were selling for $900,000 or $1.2 million. Those condos in San Ysidro that were selling for $90,000 in 1999 and were selling for $340,000 at the bubble and now are selling for, you know, whatever, maybe $180,000. So, yeah, exactly. So this guy, you know, he had his head screwed on straight. Slide number 12. Here are the 11 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And you'll notice that the points are not important. Why? Because, you know, the points are very different than they were in the 20s than they are now. So the point drops are not the important thing. The important thing to look at is the percentage declines. And we already made mention of October 19th, 1987, where the stock market dropped 22.6% in one day. And the face-to-face class, we see a little film of that real quick. But you go back to 1929, and it was 22%, but over 2 days. Right? and then a week later, another 10%. But there are other days. And notice there's 2008. 2008 makes the list where it dropped 7.78%. In that week, it actually dropped 22%. So it took a week to drop 22%. What you should notice about this is that out of the 11 worst days, 6 of them are in October, and one's in early November. Now, there are several theories, several conjectures about why this is so. And none of them are very good, except for one, which I tend to put more credence in. The problem is you can't prove it. There's no way to prove it. But again, it goes back to the genes. It goes back to our roots. 100,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago, even more than over 100 years ago, when October came around, right, that was the time of death. That was the time when we all looked around at each other and knew what was coming and realized that about a bunch of us probably ain't going to be around to make the next year, are we? Right, exactly. And there's a reason, dear students, symbolically why Halloween, All Hallows Eve, Dia de los Muertos, Dia de los Santos, why those days are at the end of October, the beginning of November. Because that's the time when we commemorate about the folks who have gone before us. We're still animals. In the modern world, we walk inside, flip a switch, surround ourselves with comfort. We have control over nature. No, we don't. We're still part of nature. As much as we'd like to forget that we are or try to act like we are not, we are. And so, whether we know it or not, when fall comes around, that's why it's called the fall, right? the crops start dying, and it starts getting cold, and the light starts going away. That's, you know, that's why Christmas is in December. It's the birth of light, the birth of light. They don't really know when Jesus was born. They think they do, but they don't. And the birth of light in the winter solstice. And then, sure, hopefully you'll make it to the springtime. So that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. And whether you believe it or not, that's up to you. Because there's no way to prove it. But October comes around, and everybody gets a little skittish. And now, a lot of it's because we know the history of the markets in October. And it doesn't mean every October is bad. In fact, many Octobers are fine, but a lot of them are bad. Slide number 13. Index funds, market indices, and manias, and crashes. Now, this slide is a review. We looked at this slide in Chapter 4, and I told you you wouldn't understand it then, but now you're going to understand it, because now you understand what PE means. If you recall, index funds and ETFs, exchange-traded funds, rely on indices. Instead of trying to beat the market, you just buy the market and be happy with the market return. But as we said back in Chapter 4 when we were trying to explain index funds, sometimes an index can become skewed, especially when a sector of the economy or a region of the world becomes hot. And that's the word they use. They say it's hot. If you remember the MSCI EAFE, Europe, Australia, and the Far East, MSCI stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International, that's the company, and the index is the EAFE. And now it's being replaced, if you remember, for Chapter 5, the All Country World Index ex USA. In 1989, the end of the 1980s, Japan's stock market had exploded. Japan was taking over the world. There was a song called I'm Turning Japanese. And the Japan's stock market was in a bubble. 51.9 PE. Now you seem to understand. You understand better with PE. That's a pretty high PE. Investors are very optimistic about the future of Japan. And the EAFE, which is meant to register to represent Europe, all of Western Europe, right? Australia, the Far East, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Japan. And yet the PE of Japan's stock market was 51.9, 50, almost 52, and because the stock's prices had gone up so high, Japan's stock market was representing almost 60% of the EAFE. Everything else, Europe, Australia, the Far East, was 40% of the index with a PE of only 13. Exactly. So you bought the EAFE, thinking you were getting a broad-based index of companies based outside the United States at the time, because the emerging markets were still nothing. There was still very, very little. And there was parts of the world that were completely closed off to markets. And you were actually buying 60% Japan with a sky-high PE and only 40% Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And what happened? We know what happened. The Japanese market hit, what, 38,000 and then fell to 8,000 and has never recovered. It's never recovered back to its high and probably won't for some time. The same thing happened at the end of the 2000s. The 1990s, the United States market did really well, specifically the information technology, internet stocks, software companies, computer companies, telecommunication companies had just done so well. The NASDAQ, which is the tech index, had gone from 800 in 2005 to 5,000 in the year 2000, March of 2000, and the S&P 500 had done pretty darn well, almost 20% throughout the 1990s. And so you, again, bought the S&P 500 thinking you're getting a hugely broadly diversified index, and yet what you were wind up buying was one-third of the index of the 500 largest companies in America were information technology companies with a PE of almost 60, and everything else, energy, healthcare, materials, everything, the housing stocks, real estate stocks, well, REITs, real estate investment trusts, railroads, food companies, all of them made up 2/3 of the index with a still pretty high PE, 19.3, but, you know, 1/3 of what the information technology. And the S&P 500 between March of 2000 to October 2002 lost 50%, but the NASDAQ lost 80%. So now you have a better understanding that indexes are not perfect. Nothing is a perfect investment. That doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in an index. You think that it's a good idea to buy a broadly diversified index fund with low annual operating expenses. Great, congratulations, do it. But realize that it ain't always going to be what they make it out to be. They're now the perfect investment if you listen to the financial advisors on the telly or on the infernal net. Slide number 14. Let's spend some time talking about anomalies, silly theories, and oddities. And you know, we really shouldn't spend much time at all because these things are ridiculous, some of them. And some of them are, something to be said for them, but not really. The Monday effect. It's the best day to buy, or is it the best day to sell? I can't remember. You look it up. The January effect. As goes January, so goes the year. Well, sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't. The Santa Claus rally. The turn of the year effect. For some reason, December actually does pretty well, usually, but not always. If it doesn't do well, then they don't call it the Santa Claus rally. They call it tax selling, because people are selling, supposedly, to, you know, lock in their tax losses or their gains. And then the one that you hear quite a bit is sell in May and go away. Well, it is true, folks, that the best gains come between November and March and the worst months of the year, September and October. But over the long term, these differences are very small. If you were to try to trade on these, your transaction costs would eat up any kind of advantage you may or may not get. Because remember, emotions get in the way. Then the Super Bowl theory. Boy, is this one weird. The weird thing is that it works. In general, when the National League wins, or supposedly a football team that was from the original National League, then the market's going to go up. And the American League, a football team wins from that, then the market's going to go down. And you think, that's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. But if you go back in history, it turns out that it's true. It's pretty darn good indicator. And you try to come up with a reason why, and the only thing I can think of, and this is other people who don't believe in fairy tales, is that it's coincidence. You know, if you look at all of the thousands, millions, thousands of hundreds of thousands of things in this world that you can correlate, and every once in a while two of them are going to come up with one another. There's a movie called The Wizard of Oz. I bet you've seen it. Scared to live in Delhi to me when I was a kid. Those flying monkeys, I had dreams for weeks. And there's a very famous album by a group called Pink Floyd, you might have heard of them, called Dark Side of the Moon, which was done, 30 years or so after the Wizard of Oz. And it turns out that if you play the album while the movie starts, or start the movie while you play the album, the scenes all switch at the perfect times. And when this was found out, I forget when it was found out, maybe 1980s, 1990s, they went back to the people who were the producers, Alan Parsons, and the members of the group, and said, did you guys do this on purpose? And they just laughed out loud. They said, no, we didn't have anything to do. We weren't watching The Wizard of Oz when we put out our album. Can you say coincidence? So for some reason, the Super Bowl follows the stock market. Hemlines of skirts. Yeah, when there were mini skirts in the 1920s and 1960s, that was supposed to be bullish. Stock prices going up, hemlines going up. Hemlines going down in the 1930s and the 1970s, and the stock market went down. Figured that one out. And there are many other silly theories, such as the lipstick indicator, the Boston snow indicator, also known as the BS indicator, like that one, the hot waitress indicator, and the aspirin count theory. And if you are so inclined, please look them up and have a laugh. And then lastly, politics and the stock market. Now, what is politics? I mean, poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects, right? Exactly. In truth, folks, as much as the politicians like to try to make the stark differences between the two parties, with regard to the economy and capitalism, they're both very, very similar. Now, the Republicans would have you think that they are the party of the markets. But if you go back and look at the administrations of presidents, it turns out that the Democrats have an edge. And why is this? Does it have anything to do with their ideology and the like? No, it's dumb luck. Hoover coming in just as the market falls 80%. Nixon in 72, 73. Reagan in 87. And then Bush the younger in 2000 through 2008. And boy, would he have wished that the crash came just a few months later after he got out of office. But that's the reason. It's just bad luck on the Republican side. But the truth is, both parties are committed. Now, do they have differences? Oh, yeah, mostly with regard to regulation. The Democrats want more regulation in general. The Republicans want less regulation in general. And, of course, we can't find a happy median. Because when you get overly regulated, things get stifled. It's hard to do business. But then if you get under-regulated, then you wind up with the crash of 2008, where people were making liar loans, saying, yes, I'm making $100,000 when I'm only making $30,000. Yes, you can afford this $500,000 loan that you can't afford. In 2-3 years, you're going to be kicked out. Yeah, so there's a special place in hell for people who over-regulate. And there's another special place in hell for people who under-regulate. And luckily, they're real close to one another, so throughout eternity, they can yell at each other. Yeah, but before you go there, let's figure this out and get it right. I don't think that's going to happen. Slide number 15. Let's take some time and take a look at the all-stars of investing. And the reasoning here, folks, from my point of view, is that you want to learn how to do something well, look at people, learn from people who have done it well. And we've already made mention of Mr. Peter Lynch. You want to read One Up on Wall Street, folks. It's a great book. He was the fund manager of Fidelity Magellan, which is a capital appreciation fund. From 1977 to 1989, 12 years, he ran up 29% a year. Ooh, wow! And then he retired because he was done with the stress. But he wrote that book, One Up on Wall Street. It's written a few others you want to take a look at, but that's the seminal work. And it's just a fun book to read. And it should be the first book you read on stocks. Warren Buffett was very interested in getting involved in investing, and he sought out Benjamin Graham. And he's become one of the world's best, if not the world's best investor, because he hasn't done 29% a year like Peter Lynch. But he's been in the business a whole lot longer than Peter Lynch. He's done around 20% a year, which is still, I mean, over 40 some odd years he's done that since the 1960s. He believes you shouldn't buy a stock. You buy a company. If you would want to buy FedEx, for example, the whole company, if you could, or UPS, if you could buy the whole company, great, buy 10 shares. Be a part owner. He's so big, and he buys the whole company. They bought Burlington Northern a few years ago, bought the whole company. It's a railroad company. His company owns Geico. Right, exactly. And Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's teacher. He's often called the father of value investing. And eventually you're going to want to read The Intelligent Investor. Security analysis is even tougher. But when you read The Intelligent Investor, make sure you read the 2002 edition, which is basically a 1972 edition, but it has commentary by Jason Zweig. And it's a great book to read. Eventually, read One Up on Wall Street, read Random Walk Down Wall Street first. Yeah. And then Sir John Templeton. Pretty good for a kid from Tennessee, right? One of the first mutual fund managers to invest globally. And on the website in chapter 4 is the link to his he died a few years ago, to his foundation that he created to explore the spiritual side of business. In other words, marrying the hard skills that we need in business and investing with the soft skills. And he was a very, very, very colorful guy, really sharp, really sharp. Let's continue. Slide number 16, and Mr. Bill Miller. Poor Bill Miller. Do you feel bad for Mr. Miller? I don't feel so bad for him, but boy, did he fall from grace. Boy, did he fall from high heights. He was the fund manager of the Legg Mason Value Trust. Do you remember the Legg Mason Value Trust from chapter number 4? Exactly. The one where he had beaten the count, the S&P 500, for 15 years in a row. Unprecedented. Reminds me of the slugger Tony Gwynn, who didn't he win it 7 times, a batting championship? Think about that. 7 times. Unbelievable. He became, unfortunately for him, as far as I was concerned, the financial media's megastar. Can you imagine trying to do your job with people asking you questions left and right, shining their 10,000-watt spotlight in your face? Oh, I'd go out of my mind. And what happened is in 2006, and then 2007, and then 2008, he started to fall and fall and fall. And he seemed to redeem himself in 2009 when he was up over 40%, beating the 26% return of the S&P 500, but then, again, stumbled badly in 2010 and 11, and then in 2012 they allowed him to retire. I'm surprised that Legg Mason let him stay as long as they did, because it's a brutal business, folks. People would ask me in 2004, 5, and 6 when I would show them his results, they would say, well, why don't you invest with him? I'd say, well, you know what, he takes too many large bets for my tastes. A mutual fund's supposed to have 100, 200 different stocks. He would have 40 or 50, which is great. It's a concentration, right? Why we buy mutual funds? Diversification. If you buy a concentrated portfolio, it's great if you do well, but then you understand. It's not so great if you don't do well. And then slide number 17. What do all these people have in common? Well, they have courage to not follow the crowd. The conventional wisdom is usually not very wise, folks. If everybody's running in one direction, in fact, on the website in chapter 7, there's a link to just one of dozens and dozens of different articles that try to tell you you should do exactly the opposite of what everybody's doing. And they have an eye for unrecognized value. I like to call it a sixth sense. They see something that others just don't see. And here is a great quote from a gentleman by the name of Garry Kasparov, another interesting fellow. If you're interested in biology, biography. Yes, if you're interested in biographies, this gentleman is a real character. He and Anatoly Karpov were the two best chess players in the world between the late 80s and into the 90s, and then finally Garry Kasparov became the undisputed champion. One would win, and the next one would win next year, though the other one would win. And while they were fighting amongst themselves, Garry Kasparov was asked why he and Anatoly Karpov were the two best chess players in the world. His answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. How do you argue with that? Can you hit the fastball at 98 miles an hour? Can you throw the fastball at 98 miles an hour? Can you buy the best companies, and can you avoid the worst companies? Because the sports fans, and I don't know if sports is such a great analogy, but it seems to work. The sports fans will tell you that offense is important, but defense is far more important. Exactly. These people bought the best companies, avoided the worst companies. Slide number 18. Speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund investor, I am not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or the next Bill Miller or the next Warren Buffett. No. I am looking to avoid the next Charles Stedman. And you're saying, well, who is Mr. Stedman? Well, he ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund, from December 1959 until his death in 1997. It's a bad thing. Name it after yourself. His cumulative total return was minus 42.9%, folks, during the largest expansion of the global economy in the history of the world. This guy lost almost 43%. He would have done much better simply placing his investors' funds into a savings account at a bank or putting them under a mattress. I don't know, maybe he came from the life insurance industry. So do you see, understand? I want to avoid this guy. I don't want to find him. Slide number 819. What does Mr. Buffett say? One of Warren Buffett's most famous quotes is this one. Be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. And does he follow his own advice? Yes, he does. He sat on his hands throughout the 2000s and said, stocks are too expensive. He bought it a little bit, but they're too expensive. I'm not going to buy more. And then in 2008, when the organic matter hit the ventilating device and the world was going to end, he wrote a very famous op-ed piece in the New York Times saying, I'm buying America. He bought $5 billion worth of Goldman Sachs, $5 billion worth of GE. A year later, bought another, I forget how much, of Bank of America. And, of course, they turned out to be brilliant moves. His mentor, Benjamin Graham, said it this way, buy when most people, including experts, are overly pessimistic, and sell when they are actively optimistic. It ain't easy to do. Everybody's running this way. Exactly. You want to run with them. You don't want to run the other way. Slide number 20. Mr. Templeton, Sir John Templeton, said, bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. But it's also the hardest time to buy. On a similar note, he also said, to buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. Now, did Mr. Sir John Templeton follow his own advice? It turns out he did. It's January 1941, and you students of history will tell me what that is, right? The World War II is already raging, and the public in the U.S. is doing its best to keep the government, our government, out of World War II. But our government, under FDR, is trying to get into World War II because they see what the Nazis are doing. And the FDR, there's some historians will battle over about whether this was happening or not, because they weren't doing it publicly, but they were pushing the Japanese, the United States was, pushing the Japanese, blockading their ports, and pushing them. And many people believed they were trying to provoke an attack. And they figured they would attack Alaska, which wasn't a state at the time, or maybe the Philippines. They never thought they would attack the Third Fleet in Hawaii. Well, we don't know. It's pure speculation. But the Japanese said, all right, you want to play this game? All right, we'll hit you right where it hurts. And in one day, one-third of the Pacific Fleet was gone. And what did Sir John Templeton do? He called up his broker and told him to buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, would you have that kind of courage? Here, the free world is about ready to fall into fascism. The Nazis are running wild over Europe. They're now in Russia. And Russia's, the Soviet Union is flailing. And you go out and buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange. 4 years later, the war was over, and Mr. Sir, he wasn't a sir yet, but John Templeton was a very wealthy man. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Yes, it is. Famous myths and stupid sayings. Now, this is what you're going to hear people say, and you just smile. Maybe you want to engage them in discussion, but usually you can't. It can't go any lower! Oh, yes, it can. It can go to zero. When can it not go any lower? When it hits zero. Once it hits zero, it can't go any lower. It can't come after you for more money. But But it doesn't matter how low it goes, it can go lower. It can't go any higher. Oh, yes, it can. There's no speed limit. There's no earn limit on the stock price. They don't put a sign up. Okay, it's $100, can't go any higher. This is what they kept saying about Philip Morris. And mostly is because they didn't like the fact that they were selling cigarettes and killing people. But the stock price kept going up and up and up. They say this about Procter & Gamble, too. It's only $3 a share. What can I lose? $3. It doesn't matter how low the price is. The price can go to zero and you can lose all your money. Price is irrelevant. Valuation is the key. It has to come back. Oh, yeah? You ever hear of Penn Central? Yeah? Pan Am? Polaroid? Kodak? Yeah, some companies don't come back. Penn Central, the largest railroad in the country, been around for over 150 years. At the time, the largest bankruptcy in history. And Mr. Graham discusses the 1969 bankruptcy in detail in his book, The Intelligent Investor, and how investors would have been able to tell that things weren't doing well at Penn Central. Slide 22. It's always darkest before the dawn. Oh, yeah? Sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. When it rebounds to 10 bucks, I'll sell. I understand what they're doing. We're going to talk about this later in Chapter 8. The person bought it at 10 bucks, and now it's down to 7 or 5 or 3, and they don't want to admit they made a mistake. If you wouldn't buy it now, sell it. Right? You've made a mistake. Go on with it. And we'll discuss this in detail in the next chapter. If it goes down 10%, sell. I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to protect you from large losses. But the problem is stock prices fluctuate greatly, even blue chips. So if you sold each stock that automatically lost 10%, you automatically sold it, and what a lot of traders will do, speculators will set stops. Remember we talked about stop transactions, stop loss transactions that automatically sell if you lose a certain amount. The problem is you're almost always going to sell all your winners along with your losers. And you'll hear people say it's taking too long. Well, patience is an investor's most important trait. It's going to take long. It doesn't happen overnight. Plus, it gives you a chance to buy more shares. Look at all the money I lost. I didn't buy it on slide 23, huh? You didn't lose a cent by not buying a stock you did well. Don't fret over it. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. Well, the problem is the next one doesn't come. Rarely makes it. Sometimes it does, but the next Google, there's not going to be a next Google. There's another technology, Facebook, and they're trying to steal Google's face technology. They're trying to become, well, they're not becoming the next Google. They're trying to make Google obsolete, right? But whether they do or not, we'll see. But there's not going to be another search engine in the mold of Google. There's not going to be another Microsoft, right? So buy Microsoft. If you're looking at a software company but then there's a whole new technology that hopefully they're going to, Google's trying to supplant Microsoft with Google Docs, and we'll see. But sometimes there is a next one. In the case of Home Depot, yeah, Lowe's came along and gave them a run for their money. The stock's gone up. I must be a genius. There's a saying, never mistake a bull market for brains, folks. The stock's gone up doesn't mean you're a genius. The market's going up. In fact, you'll talk to people who got into investing just at the right time, or so they believed at the time, 1962, 1982, and the market just goes straight up, and they think they're invincible. And then afterwards they say, oh boy, was that a bad thing, because I thought that I could do no wrong, and then along comes a bear market, and the stock's gone down, I must be an idiot. No, it has nothing to do with you. You could have made perfectly reasonable decisions. You will, based on the information that is given to you and your judgment, and make a mistake, and something completely, totally unrelated happens. Think of the poor folks at Yum Brands. What is Yum? That's Kentucky Fried Rat, Pizza Crap, and Taco Hell. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Anyway, Kentucky Fried Chicken, it was doing gangbusters in China. They were just wiping up McDonald's all over the map. And then along comes the bird flu. It has never been documented that anybody has gotten the bird flu from a chicken that's been killed and cooked. It has to be alive. The bird has to be alive, but that doesn't matter people believe that they can get bird flu from a cooked chicken. Then all the Kentucky Fried Chickens were empty. It was just, and nothing to do with the company, well-run company. I don't particularly like their products because they're garbage and they're bad for your health, and they cost a lot of money, folks. But that's where we're getting into business 121. Slide number 24. It's different this time. Well, boy. Remember that saying. When you start hearing that, you know we're about ready. Maybe it might take a few years, but there's going to be bodies on the floor. Technically, it's different every time. every day is different. But that doesn't mean you should pay an astronomical price for a company that probably will never make a dollar's worth of profit. This is what's happening with the internet stocks in the 1990s. They were paying outrageous amounts for companies that publicly stated, we're probably not going to make any money for at least 5 or 10 years. And if you don't make any money for at least 5 or 10 years, it's most likely that you won't be around in 5 or 10 years. And sure enough, most of them weren't. It's a new era. That's the same as it's different this time. It's a permanent trend. Now, wait a minute. I love this quote. This is from Andrew Tobias, who's a wonderful writer, folks. You want to read his stuff. And he talks about people saying it's a permanent trend. That's an oxymoron, right? Heavy on the moron. Military intelligence, jumbo shrimp, straight curve. Exactly. They don't mean the two things don't belong with one another. Markets move in cycles, and trends are trends because they are temporary. And then, as an investor, you're going to have people come up to you when you talk about this, or maybe it depends. Oh, man, stocks are just too risky. And you really have to acknowledge that. You have to give them their due. You have to acknowledge that you're right. Stocks are risky. But even with all the shenanigans and the stupidity and the silliness, they are still the best long-term financial investment going. There's no guarantees, right, when you deal with the stock world. And there's all kinds of ridiculousness and all kinds of shenanigans. But if you're a prudent long-term investor, you should do well. Come back in 5, 10 years and we'll see, right? So far, so good for my wife and I. Slide 25. So that is our discussion of stock price behavior and market efficiency and asking whether or not you can beat the market. Now, when we come back, we're going to see some real silliness as we discuss behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. And we'll also take a look at what is called technical analysis. And there's the silliness of them all when it comes to stock investing. So see you in our next and final chapter on stocks.